More about the U.S. Supreme Court's abortion ruling for Texas and how the exact same case could end up before the high court again. On Insight, there are many facets to this decision. I'll explore them with McGeorge Law Professor Leslie Jacobs and from UC Davis, Law Professor Lisa Pruitt. Then we'll focus on low-income housing and the rights of renters. Not all cities have a rental inspection program, but Sacramento does. We'll talk more about that. Later in the program, Serious Talk. Seriously. That's the name of a Sacramento-based podcast. It's celebrating its second anniversary. We'll meet its host and creator, Johnny Flores. And then the world premiere of A Revolutionary Mind at California Stage. It's getting great reviews. The playwright and one of the actors will join me. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's coming up today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Yesterday's Supreme Court decision on abortion is considered one of the most influential the High Court has handed down since 1992. The justices voted 5-3, and we spent a few minutes on this decision yesterday with civil rights attorney Maria Blanco from UC Davis. But we're going to expand the conversation today with McGeorge constitutional law scholar Leslie Jacobs, who is joining us by phone from Michigan. Hello, Professor Jacobs.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for joining us again. And in the studio with me from UC Davis Law School is Professor Lisa Pruitt. Hi, Professor Pruitt. Glad to have you here.
Thanks.
So the High Court struck down this Texas law that would have required abortion clinics to have surgical centers and required certain hospital privileges for doctors. Professor Pruitt, to you, was this decision more about women's health and safety or the right to choose?
Well, the Texas legislature certainly held Texas House Bill 2 out as being about protecting women's health and safety. But the Supreme Court majority in the ruling issued yesterday really rejected that rationale, if you will, for the Texas law and said, no, we have clear precedent in the Casey decision from 1992, and it says that states cannot impose an undue burden or a substantial obstacle on a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy. And so they went through a very extensive and careful balancing of the purported benefits of the Texas law for women's health. And they found that there really were very, very few benefits, and that those benefits, those very few benefits, were greatly outweighed by the burden on a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy. That burden kicking in because so many Texas abortion clinics were forced to close during the period when the hospital admitting privileges requirement was in effect.
It's interesting because it was said to be an anti-women law by those who support the right to choose, and then it was said to be an anti-women decision by those who are arguing for women's health and safety. There is no common ground here in this case, is there?
Well, I think that's one of the very difficult, aspects of the abortion debate is that the two sides tend to really talk past each other because— for pro-choice forces, the ultimate value is a woman's right to choose. And from, the pro-life or the anti-choice forces, there really can never be a reason to terminate a pregnancy. So it's an issue that's obviously fraught with deeply held emotion on both sides. And so we do often see the two sides really not engaging each other in a very meaningful way. And if you read the majority in the dissent from yesterday's opinion, you really see that played out again.
Professor Jacobs, what's your reaction to the 5-3 vote and Justice Stephen Breyer's opinion?
Well, I guess I'd agree with Professor Pruitt. To me, I was always looking at this case as deciding how much the court was going to defer or believe what the state legislatures say about health and safety. And it applies in this area. It applies across a bunch of other areas. But the question was the court going to say, well, the state can just choose and say, in fact, that there's a health and safety benefit here, or is there some role for the court? Does the Constitution require that the court do some analysis by itself and figure out, you know, is there really a health and safety benefit here? So it's highly significant to me, quite frankly, that Justice Kennedy was in the majority. When I looked at what he'd said before, I wouldn't have put him there. So that's surprising to me. I guess the other thing I'll point out, too, which Professor Pruitt was pointing out, is the importance of facts here. And the court's looking at facts. And way back in the 1992 decision, facts made a big difference also. And the briefing by the parties and showing the you know, the facts on the ground about how things operate. And so it's interesting to me that the court looked at that and cared so much.
I guess one of the underlying questions there is whether the high court was being asked to be a medical board. And Professor Jacobs, did you read it that way at all?
I guess no. I didn't see them being asked to be a medical board. I think in any sort of case or all sorts of cases, interpreting statutes, interpreting the Constitution, the court has to look at what government entities are doing and say, is it minimally reasonable, the decision that they're making? And so as opposed to deciding the truth of something, they were simply saying, could this legislature really have thought these things? And so I don't see that as unusual, and I don't think that's what a medical board does.
So the ruling might deter other states from passing these types of laws that are sometimes called clinic shutdown laws. Professor Pruitt, will you frame this in California in as much as the state has its own history and the culture of a state determines its laws? So has California approached the abortion discussion, debate, dilemma through this avenue ever?
Well, Professor Jacobs has lived in California longer than I have, and she may be better versed on this particular issue. The current situation in California is that California is one of the most liberal states in the nation in terms of permitting abortions. So to the point of permitting medication abortions, I believe that even nurse practitioners may be permitted in some instances to prescribe the abortion pill. So California is, and presumably has always been, again, as you suggest, reflecting its culture, very progressive in terms of a woman's right to choose to terminate her pregnancy. And I think your contrast is an appropriate one because obviously we saw in the Hellerstedt case decided yesterday that Texas had had really gone to the other extreme. Maybe it had the most extreme onerous regulations sort of deterring abortions of any state in the nation, but it's certainly not alone in having recently gone down that path. And most of the states in the South, in the Deep South is what everyone is saying in the papers this morning, right? Those states are rigorously regulating abortion in what are called these targeted regulation of abortion providers with statutes that are very, very similar to Texas's in terms of requiring admitting privileges, requiring providers to meet the standards of ambulatory surgical centers. So you do see looking at, you know, the states across the nation, you know, very different approaches to abortion and how it should be regulated or effectively hardly regulated at all. You know, compared to similar sorts of procedures. One of the things I thought that was very interesting and relatable about yesterday's decision was Breyer's, you know, comparison of the dangers of an abortion to the dangers of a colonoscopy. Apparently, you're 10 times more likely to die from a colonoscopy than you are from an abortion. And so I think using that example, it was very relatable to many people, including men, right, that this is not, you know, what the medical evidence shows us is abortion is not a particularly dangerous procedure. And so it would not merit the level of regulation that Texas has imposed on it.
Professor Jacobs, do you want to add more about the California perspective?
I would agree with Professor Pruitt. I think women in California, well, maybe this sounds bad, but aren't particularly affected by this particular decision in the sense that they weren't under the threat immediately of having laws passed that would be like the one in Texas. But nevertheless, certainly they're impacted if they go to other places, and I agree that the impact is more in other states that were more inclined to pass restrictive abortion laws.
The restrictions had prompted the closure of, as we're hearing, about half the clinics in Texas. So what happens now, Professor Jacobs? Is there an immediate reversal or an immediate ability for clinics either to reopen or open new again?
Sure.
And then this case can come back, this exact argument can come back through the courts there and end up at the high court again, if I understand that right. Yes?
No. I mean, no, this is an opinion that establishes a precedent from the United States Supreme Court. So they're not allowed to pass laws that are exactly like this. Now, if states want to pass different laws, and they do have a bunch of different laws that are passed having to do with ultrasounds and maybe sizes of rooms and things like that, if it's not the same as what the Supreme Court has ruled upon, then yes, it can indeed go back up through the courts. But this sets the precedent about one thing we know now, these particular laws are undue burdens, and so you can't do exactly that or anything more than that.
I thought there was a pathway to argue on the merits. That was,
well, one possibility, and this may be what you're thinking or what you've read about, is that another state that has a similar regulation, so an admitting privileges requirement, but has a very different landscape in terms of spatial distance, population centers, and so forth. Now, I'm not saying it would be a winning argument. I think it would be an extremely difficult argument to make. But as Professor Jacobs indicated, this decision was extremely fact-intensive. So there was a great deal of discussion here about the details, the statistics on the effect that this law had on Texas's women. How many of them would now have to travel 200 miles to an abortion provider? The percentage of them, you know, who would have to travel more than 200 miles, and, you know, lots and lots of data points. And, you know, as Texans like to say, everything's bigger in Texas. And it is the second largest state in the nation. It's the second most populous state in the nation. So it's conceivable that another state that has an admitting privileges requirement would say, well, it doesn't have the same impact in our jurisdiction because we're just little old Indiana or something like that. Again, I think it would be an extremely, extremely difficult argument to win because the court, you know, five justices have very clearly and decisively said, you know, these admitting privileges laws, these ambulatory surgical center laws, they simply, you know, don't outweigh the burden that they place on a woman's right to terminate a pregnancy.
You are listening to UC Davis Law Professor Lisa Pruitt. Also joining me is Leslie Jacobs from UOP's McGeorge School of Law. And we are discussing that Supreme Court decision, the ruling that we heard yesterday on the Texas law regarding abortion clinics. But I want to broaden this a little bit. Professor Jacobs, President Obama had nominated Merrick Garland to fill the seat of Justice Antonin Scalia. There would not have been enough time for a confirmation for Garland to be involved in this session's key decisions, correct?
Well, I don't actually agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I think they could have done it fast if they wanted to do it fast. There's no reason why they couldn't have. So I think they could have been involved. But it would have had to have been quick, and people would have had to have been very motivated.
So tell me how the absence of Justice Scalia impacted these end-of-session decisions, the big ones that we've seen since last Thursday, starting with the immigration DAPA-DACA decision.
Oh, okay. And I'll note, too, the union dues decision that was talked about right in the intro to the Insight program, and that's one that made a difference, that Justice Scalia wasn't there. Certainly everybody thought, and with him I think it's true, that the result would have been different. If, in fact, he'd been there, it would have been a decision holding that the Constitution prohibits public unions from charging dues, even for collective bargaining. So that's one of them. The United States versus Texas, yep, the absence of Scalia made a difference there. And it's a little bit different than some of the other cases, too, just because what it's doing by the Supreme Court not issuing a decision because it was 4-4, so it's simply affirming what happened below. It's affirming an interim order issued by one district court judge and then upheld in a split 2-1 decision by the circuit court. So it's fairly significant that the United States Supreme Court didn't have a say in it because of the 4-4 split. And then, even the Fisher case, the affirmative action case, would have been different. I think if Justice Scalia was there, we certainly had Justice Kennedy in the majority, but Justice Kagan was out, which shifted the balance.
Right.
Okay, and so if, in fact, Justice Scalia would have been there, we would have had a split decision, likely again, and it wouldn't have had the precedential value that certainly the affirmative action case has.
Could I get your reaction on the fact that the court has turned down a rehearing possibility for the Friedrichs case?
Well, not surprising at all. Why would they rehear it at this point? It's unusual for them to rehear a case, and it would make no sense, I think, at this point. There's no additional justice, no reason for them to keep it on the books.
And Professor Pruitt, your view of the court right now with 8 members and the possibilities of continuing 4-4 splits, and how quickly you think a justice might be able to be confirmed and put into place after the November election, assuming nothing can or will happen before then?
Well, I mean, you know, as Professor Jacobs said, if you have highly motivated players in the Senate in particular, right, to consider a nominee, then it could be done within a month of, you know, of our new president in January. But that's still going to leave that new justice probably not being able to participate, right, in a lot of the cases that the court will be hearing this fall, starting in the October term 2016. So it's still going to leave, it's going to leave the existing dynamic probably, right, for at least another 6 months. And that means, you know, a number of cases that will be considered, a number of new cases that will be considered starting in October.
So finally, a yes or no question to each of you. Do you think it's likely that Merrick Garland does find a pathway to the Supreme Court, or that his legacy ends up being the nominee that was talked about for many, many months but never actually put through the process? So the question is it likely that he goes to the high court? Yes or no? Professor Pruitt?
I think it's unlikely at this point. I think that even if we have another Democratic president, if Hillary Clinton becomes president, that she's unlikely to choose him as her nominee. And, obviously Donald Trump, I don't think anyone would argue, is going to choose Merrick Garland as his nominee. So I'm afraid that for Judge Garland, who's obviously a judge with just amazing, impeccable, you know, fantastic credentials, it's just not his time.
And Professor Jacobs, same question.
Well, I think you hit on it by saying, you said, the person who's been talked about so much. I guess what I have to say is I don't think he's been talked about that much. And I think the question about whether he's going to get confirmed, and right now when we're talking about him possibly being confirmed, we're talking about after the election, right, in November, and some motivation by the Senate to, in fact, confirm him, it would depend upon public pressure. And people are saying, these middle ground Republican senators are feeling pressure in their home states. I'm just not sure it's true. I'm not sure people care enough about this to force a hearing on him. And so I guess I would have to say that I would put the odds that it's going to be the next president who chooses the next Supreme Court justice.
Thank you so much for the conversation. Glad to have both of you join us today and be able to expand the discussion a little bit.
I was happy to be here.
Thank you, Professor Jacobs. Thank you, Professor Pruitt.
Thank you.
Lisa Pruitt from UC Davis, Leslie Jacobs from UOP's McGeorge School of Law. There are a number of additional stories about the recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions. You can find them at capradio.org. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Let's talk now about living conditions, rental conditions specifically. Across the country, studies suggest that 1 in every 7 poor families have inadequate housing. And by that definition, there is no hot water, no working electricity, no toilet or bathtub or shower. In a 2010 study of low-income families living in Los Angeles in substandard housing, 75% had cockroaches, 40% had rats or mice, 45% had mold. What's the story in Sacramento? With me in the studio is Rachel Isco. She is CEO of Mutual Housing California. She also chairs the board of the California Coalition for Rural Housing and is on the board of the Sacramento Housing Alliance. Hi, Rachel.
Hi,
glad
Beth.
To have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Also part of this conversation, the former director of the Sacramento Community Development Department, Max Fernandez. He's also on the board of Mutual Housing California. Mr. Fernandez, glad to have you here.
Thank you, Beth.
So, Rachel, would you start with a story of inspecting a Sacramento complex? And you were asked to take this over, but just describe, after I've talked about vivid conditions in other parts of the country, what you saw in Sacramento.
Okay. Well, I had been on my job about 10 years, and we had been, Mutual Housing develops and operates permanently affordable housing, new construction, but we also have to take over deteriorated apartments that owners don't take care of, and we renovate those. So we had been renovating and taking over large apartment complexes as large as 124 apartments that owners had just let go to rot, really. And in 2005, our residents of one of our properties called us and told us about the apartment complex next door. It was small. It was about 15 apartments. And they were worried about the residents. So we walked through that. We were able to walk through the apartments. And it was maybe not the worst living conditions I'd seen in deteriorated apartment complex in the city of Sacramento. But I think what struck me is that it was nap time and little toddlers were sleeping next to exposed wiring, furnaces that were hooked up with wiring that just shouldn't be there, holes in ceilings that obviously would leak in the winter. It was so disturbing. It brought me to tears, really. And we immediately called city council members and asked them to tour the property. Well, we were able to take that over, but we had to. It was not even, we weren't even able to renovate it. It had to be torn down and we rebuilt. There's so little money, state, federal, local, for affordable housing development. We just don't want to see that scarce money being used to rebuild housing that should have been taken care of by their landlords in the first place. And that's what got Mutual Housing kind of on the bandwagon to try and get a successful rental housing inspection ordinance in the city of Sacramento back then.
In 2005, Max, she mentioned a couple interesting things. Somebody happened to call their office, which, number one, you were dependent upon a Good Samaritan type of call. Number two, then city council members had to be brought in. And all of this means that there wasn't a mechanism in place in 2005, was there?
No, there wasn't. It was strictly on a referral basis. Like you said, a Good Samaritan, or people would have to have the guts, if I can use that word, to call the city building inspector and get an inspection on their property where there were issues, substandard code issues. So the real bottom line here is that people have to give us, well, in those days, had to give us a call. Otherwise, we wouldn't know. So that was the that was kind of like the common denominator, if I can use that, that we weren't getting out to these substandard properties until some tragedies happened back in those days.
And by 2008, you were putting a process in place. And what is the inspection plan today? And speak to the rights of renters today, too.
Okay, well, obviously the plan was to be able to proactively inspect these rental units. And one of the big issues that Rachel didn't mention was inoperable smoke detectors. That's a big one. Mm. That's a big one. One of the things that we had to look at was How many inspections did we do in a year, and how many of those inspections were considered substandard, and then what was the percentage of rentals? So it was about 85% of the substandard inspections were rental housing. Mm. So we could, we could kind of make the assumption that many renters were not calling the city building inspector to report substandard conditions for a lot of reasons: fear, ignorance, not knowing that what the codes were, language barriers, and the like. And I think one of the things that this program did was it made that all moot, because if we're going out proactively inspecting every rental unit, then that gets thrown out the window. We're going to be able to go into every unit, at least on the first go round, to verify if they're standard, up to code, and then go from there.
So now in the city of Sacramento, every rental property is inspected in a 5-year period. If they pass the inspection with flying colors, basically, the next 5 years they can self-certify until they're found in violation. That first 5-year period, the city inspectors caught so many violations. They found 69% of the units they inspected in that first year in 2008, when the ordinance was placed in effect, were in violation. So, and many had multiple violations. By 2011, owners had gotten wind of what was going on, so they'd get their inspection notice and they'd clean up their act. So the city of Sacramento's policy has made housing so much safer and healthier for elderly people, any vulnerable population, young children. It's been a complete success in the city of Sacramento.
But it's not happening in most cities across the country, right? To some degree, this is a model program in Sacramento. I understand the county and the city of Davis, just to name a few entities in the area, are also pushing for the same kind of a program. Is that right, Rachel?
So Sacramento City has 70,000 rental units. The county of Sacramento, the unincorporated county, there's over 100,000 rental units. And right now, it's a self-certification program. So if I own a rental housing unit, be it single family or in a multifamily property, I'm required to register as the owner of that unit, tell the county it's a rental, but I don't need to... I don't need to get an inspection by the government. And the problem with that, they just don't have the money. It's not the inspection department's fault, because they have very few inspectors. They don't even have the administrative staff to make sure everyone's registering. Mm-hmm. So there's a huge supply in the unincorporated county of single-family units being used as rental housing. Only 15% of those are registered under the program. So even the basic part of that program, registering, is not happening. And the City of Davis, the same thing. Both of those programs, City of Davis, unincorporated Sacramento County, they're both reactive programs, like Max was talking about. Reactive programs don't work because people are afraid of eviction. They can't speak English. They are afraid of government. They don't know they can call and get an inspection. They don't work. And we still have these reactive programs in our region.
You're listening to Rachel Isco. Also in the studio is Max Fernandez. They are both from Mutual Housing California, which I believe it's a nonprofit, isn't it?
That's correct.
It develops, operates, and advocates for sustainable rental housing. Max, can you speak to some of the practical ways that Mutual Housing has been able to help? Aside from these mandatory inspections, you're still somewhat dependent, as Rachel said, on that call, that reach out for help and information.
Well, I think one of the things that Mutual Housing has done over the last certainly 10 years and more is set the standard for rental housing. So, all one person has to do is go into one of their units and they can see what it's like for people to live in safe, affordable housing. Just because it's quote-unquote affordable doesn't mean it needs to be substandard or the maintenance needs to be held at a different level. than your own home that you live in. So there's certain things that is incumbent upon landlords, upon the owners of these rental properties, to maintain. And I think one of the things that Mutual Housing's done is kind of set the bar at a fairly high level, but it's still what you don't want is a tragical circumstance to occur in a rental home because the people didn't know, because they were afraid, because there was a language issue or whatever. I mean, so I think that's an important issue.
Rachel, Mutual Housing has more than 3,000 residents. So if you have that group of people, you're targeting certain households, are you putting them into existing housing or are you developing most of that housing?
So it's about half and half. So Mutual Housing both constructs new rental housing, apartments and townhomes that's affordable to people on modest budgets. So we do very high quality, sustainable new construction. And we also take over these deteriorated apartment complexes and do green renovations of those, put solar photovoltaics on and put people in them. But we recognize with the very few resources available to build, subsidize, and renovate housing for affordable housing, it's so important that Mutual Housing advocate for these rental housing inspection ordinances so the vast majority of renters can live in very safe housing. And so we consider one of our roles to educate the public about why these are important. Neighborhood organizations, once they hear about it, understand this is important for my neighborhood, having effective rental housing inspections. And then educating renters in the city and county of Sacramento, they can just call 311 if they feel they need an inspection, if they want to check on whether the landlord is not keeping up the unit, if there's violations under state housing code.
And just to pause there, 311 gets them to where?
That will get them to it's a city and county line that they can report a problem with their rental unit, and they will get an inspector out to
so
their property.
A renter just has to call 311 and say, I'm a renter. I have no electricity or exposed wires. I have a cockroach problem. I have whatever, and I would like an inspection.
That's exactly correct.
That is a simple action step that probably is extremely empowering if you're able to take the step and make the call.
It's very important, yeah.
The 311 operators have a direct line into the city's code enforcement and building inspection staff to where they even know who works in a certain area of the city, in a certain neighborhood. So
I think we've touched just the beginnings of how deep the problem can be, but the resources that are out there too for people. So we'll post a link to Mutual Housing and some other resources. And again, a reminder that 311 call can be the first step. So thank you both for joining me today for this conversation.
Thank you for
having us. Thank you.
Thanks,
Beth.
That's Rachel Isco. She is CEO of Mutual Housing California. Max Fernandez is a board member and the former director of the Sacramento Community Development Department. And again, that information will be at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Steve Milne is standing by with more news. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Beth. IKEA is recalling 29 million chests and dressers after 6 children were killed when the furniture toppled over and fell on them. The company says that all chests and dressers should be attached to a wall to prevent them from toppling over. The company says anyone who owns a chest or dresser that is not mounted to a wall should put them out of reach from children. IKEA is offering free kits to attach the chests and dressers to a wall. Customers can also ask IKEA for a refund. In Modesto, authorities say a man was arrested on suspicion of attempted murder after he held a gun to the head of a barista at a drive-through coffee shop. The incident happened at Pink Panther's Espresso, where baristas serve coffee in their bikinis. CAL FIRE says more than 5,200 firefighters are battling 9 wildfires throughout the state. The latest one is in San Luis Obispo County, the Fraser Fire. That's burned 75 acres. It's 50% contained. The deadly Erskine Fire in Kern County has scorched nearly 47,000 acres. That's 45% contained. 2 people have died. In Santa Barbara County, the Sherpa Fire is 93% contained at almost 7,500 acres. And the Pony Fire in Siskiyou County near Happy Camp has blackened more than 2,800 acres. It's 63% contained. Follow us on Twitter at Cap Radio News.
Thanks a lot, Steve.
You're welcome, Beth.
A podcast is a digital program that can be downloaded from the internet. Simple as that. It's usually part of a series. Often it has a theme, and a podcast can be in audio and or video. Insight, for example, is available in a podcast. Another podcast originating in Sacramento just celebrated its 2-year anniversary, and that's a big landmark for a podcast. This one is called Serious Talk Seriously. Its creator and host is Johnny Flores, and he's in the studio with me. Welcome. It's nice to meet you.
Thanks. Yeah. Thank you for having me on.
Tell me about podcasting and why it intrigued you.
Well, I have always, I've loved conversational shows. I was a big fan of Johnny Carson when I was a kid and David Letterman, and a neighbor across the street from me had recording equipment and wanted to do a podcast. So we started talking back and forth, and I didn't quite know what that was. So he's like, go look up a couple different things. And, you know, Mark Maron's WTF is probably the gold standard of podcasting. And that got me into it. And I was just like, oh, so this is something anybody can do if you have, you know, kind of the drive to get it going. And that's basically what got me into it. Was
so that was a little more than 2 years ago as yep. you're ramping up to how to do it. And what was your vision, or how much of a vision did you have?
I didn't exactly know. I wanted to talk to people in Sacramento. I had been a semi-professional illustrator for a long time and was doing a lot of posters for like Clay Nutting and like Sean Slaughter and a couple other people in town, bands like Agent Ribbons. And through doing that, I got to meet a lot of amazing people that were working on things that I didn't think people quite knew about, or maybe the mainstream didn't know about. So, and I thought that was kind of like a little niche I could fill in town. And I didn't want it to be about bigger things, or I shouldn't say bigger things. I didn't want it to be about like a national thing. I wanted it to be about Sacramento and Northern California. And so I kind of started talking to those people and say, hey, would you want to be a guest on the podcast? And I kind of built some cachet of just friendship with these folks and got them on. And it just one after another, people were like, you should talk to this person. You should talk to this person. And just kept snowballing and snowballing. And now I constantly have, I'm not trying to brag here, humble brag, but constantly having people like, hey, can you talk to me or talk to my friend about this project they're working on? And it's been a really amazing experience.
Your guests have included the candidates for mayor recently, bands. You've had Tara Lopez from Sister Crayon, entrepreneur Ginger Elizabeth. You've even had some of our own Cap Radio staffers on. I believe we have a clip from Devin Yamanaka's visit. Let's listen.
Well, thanks for coming over.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
Was this your day off? Or
yeah.
Do you
yeah.
ever get a day off when you're doing the news? Or
yes and no. I mean, it's my, as a host and not a reporter, I have the luxury of kind of being usually if news breaks, if we had to go live and be live continuously, then I think they'd call me in. But I'm not a reporter, so if news breaks and they need someone to write a story, they're not going to call me because I don't know how to do it. I mean, and if they called me, I'd think, wow, we must be really low on reporters today. We must have people on vacation and people sick and stuff. So
that's an example with Devin, who is funny anyway, but you do have humor in your podcast. It's not all serious talk.
No, yeah, the Serious Talk Seriously name is to imply like, yes, it's we will get into serious stuff. But for the most part, I try to keep it humorous, and it's completely improvised. I don't do a lot of research ahead of time because I try to come from the perspective of the listener. Like, who is this person? Why should I be paying attention to him? And so I kind of figure that out along with the listener, too, at the same time.
Melody Stone had a great conversation with you, one of our digital producers. It was great to have
you. She has a great podcast, too.
And she does that as well. By the way, thanks for retweeting so many of our tweets here on Insight.
I love Capital Public Radio. I'm an Evergreen donor. I love your show. There's so many things I love about Capital Public Radio, and I love to retweet.
We're not even in Fun Drive. That was terrific. By the way, do you still have to explain to people what a podcast is and what you're doing?
Yes. A lot of perfect example is my girlfriend's dad works. He's been working in broadcasting for a long time. And I approached him about maybe doing a podcast network. And he was trying to wrap his mind around, so what do we do at the top of the hour, the bottom of the hour? When are we doing commercial breaks? And I was like, well, it doesn't quite work that way. I try to explain, like, when you go to, it's like a 24-hour store, and you can just go in there and pick whatever you want, whenever you want, and listen to it whenever you want. And that, I think, kind of helps people get what a podcast is.
That's a good way to describe it. What has surprised you about the process, being able to create this and put it out there?
How much work it takes. I did one previously. It was like a nerdy roundtable discussion about, you know, books, TV, comic books, television shows, movies. And that one, we just kind of winged it. And it wouldn't be up for like 2 months. And then we would do 3 episodes in a month. And I really wanted to have more structure for this one. And I didn't realize going into it. Well, I was unemployed when I first started this, so I had all the time in the world. And now, you know, I've been, you know, employed for a while now. And my girlfriend and I bought a house. And so just all the work that goes into a weekly podcast it's a lot.
The obvious question there, I can hear people thinking it is, are you making money from the podcast? Or do you mean you bought a house because of another day job?
Oh, no, my day job. Yeah.
It's
a time-consuming hobby. There's a little money coming in from it, but not much.
All right. One more question, Johnny, and I think you know I'm going to ask you this. Who's on your wish list? You celebrated your second anniversary,
yes.
You're full speed into your third year.
Yep.
Who do you want to have on your show this year?
I would love to have the band Death Grips on. They probably wouldn't do it. They're too big now. I'd love to talk to Cake. I've reached out to them a couple different times and have gotten polite no's. Yourself, I would love to have you on. Stan Atkinson, I've reached out to him a couple different times, and there's always seems to be a right back in a couple months. I would love to talk to Stan Atkinson. I think I grew up here, and he was just an important part of Sacramento for so many years. And I would just love to talk to him, sit down and chat with him for a while.
Well, you just delivered a terrific invitation, so we'll see if that happens.
No pressure.
I fully expect you to be celebrating your third anniversary, so I look forward to talking to you again. As I said, it's really nice to meet you. Congratulations on doing something that does take a lot of work, is not easy to do, and you've been doing it steadily, consistently. Yeah. Good job.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Johnny Flores. He is the host and creator of the podcast Serious Talk Seriously, and you can find a link at capradio.org/insight. Still ahead, a revolutionary mind, now at Cal Stage. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. Listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruiak. The world premiere of a new play from the acclaimed playwright Leslie LeWinter Susskind is playing at California Stage through July 17th. It's titled A Revolutionary Mind. It follows a former activist turned housewife whose daughter is kidnapped while working on a documentary film. It's one of the few American plays that deals with the Vietnam era from a woman's perspective. On the phone with us is Leslie LeWinter Susskind. Hi, Leslie. Glad you're here.
And I'm glad to be here, too. Thanks, Beth.
In the studio with me is actor Berman Obaldia. He plays Raimundo Glazer. Hi, Berman.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here as well. So, Leslie, I know Sacramento was your home for a while. You've had some success here, but this is a totally different play for you, isn't it?
It's the other end of the spectrum from a comedy about adultery to a very serious play about what happens to people in life.
Is there a firsthand personal interaction that gave you this perspective to see Vietnam from the woman's view?
Well, that's very interesting because during that period, I was really overseas in the Peace Corps, and it was coming back kind of, well, I always said that the 60s began in 1968, but a friend of mine who was actually in the United States said it really started in about 1960. I think my perspective comes from just living, just observing. And maybe, again, the work that I did in the field.
Berman, will you talk to me about your character and the main character, Susan, who is played by Marion Jeffrey, and the interaction the two of you have? And her transformation is really the crux of this play.
It is. And the character that I play is based on a real-life person who regrettably disappeared in 1976 at the hands of the Argentinian government at that point. And so I think that's where Leslie draws a lot of the characters. Raimundo is what Susan wanted to be. The espouses, the philosophies. He put them in action and suffered the consequences of his life. And Susan, the character, carries the same ideals as was happening during the 60s. However, other things took precedence, getting married, raising kids, and making a life for themselves, for herself and her husband and her family. That got intermixed with the realities of life. And
Raimundo, though, is her hero.
He is. He's a larger-than-life character in her eyes. And I think what Leslie's written about is he's almost a composite of different characters, Che Guevara, Fidel Castro, others that, and I'm not, it's not necessarily communism per se, but individuals that really dedicated themselves to a movement. And you can include Martin Luther King into that and Malcolm X and so forth. But he is largely a symbol that's not really known about in the United States. And this play helps promote his efforts.
Go ahead, Leslie, add to that.
Well, actually, it's very interesting, and I think that Raimundo, I'd like to call actually Berman Raimundo because he's fantastic. I think that there's another point basically in the play, and that we all in our lives have from here to here, and that's it. And whatever we're going to do has to be between those two points. And if you don't do it, which is what we see in Susan, if you don't do something you dream of doing, you might blink your eyes twice and find out it's too late. But going back to Raimundo, that doesn't always mean that because you do carry out those early dreams that it's going to be perfect ending either. It's a very hard call, this thing called life, right? And that's one thing that the play's about.
I think of that word dis-ease, Leslie. You get disease, and it means you have this dis-ease with your life. You're not able to fully explore the transformation that perhaps you were destined for.
Yes. Well, you know, we don't know what we're destined for because, in fact, we do, in a sense, manipulate our destiny. What is in the brain that allows one person to do it versus another person not able to do it is a big question. But it, for sure, in this play, Susan, who's carrying on and essentially a dialogue with herself, wakes up one day and finds out that yes, she does not has not fulfilled what she thought she was going to fulfill.
So she has this struggle about whether to have a home life or to be an advocate for the rights of the poor, and she has to reconcile her ideals. Berman, do you see Raimundo trying to reconcile anything? He's so clear that he's an activist, and that's what his life is about.
Yes, and he came from an activist family. His mom was an actress. And he, his parents were really active in the political movement. So if you go back to what was happening in Latin America in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and what Raimundo was covering was a lot of the turmoil, particularly at the hands of the United States. That the United States was heavily involved in Latin America during that period and supporting different regimes as part of their political geopolitical aspects. So he was visceral. He lived it. He was tortured at the hands of the government. He represents those 30,000 plus Argentinians that marked a really bleak bleak period in Argentinian life. And it's celebrated just recently, every May. Mothers and daughters of those that disappeared gather in the Zocalos of Argentina to pay homage to those people that lost.
Bringing it to present day, though, Leslie, this is especially relevant during this election year, isn't it?
It is. And the truth is that's one of the things that, if I'm allowed to say it, that's a very good point, because I think that while a person can gain power, and this is another thing that this play is about, while a person can gain power, as Berman is saying, you know, the Ogonias, the Videlas, the Pinochets, the Hitlers, the Genghis Khans, the Idi Amins, we all know the atrocities that are attributed to them, just as we know in Argentina, we can attribute it to Videla and Ogonia. But I think one of the things that this play...
Hey, Leslie.
Yes, I'm sorry.
I'm going to have to stop you right there, and I'll direct people to Jeff Hudson's review. I'm out of time, but thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you very much, Beth.
That's
thank
playwright
you,
Leslie LeWinter Susskind, and in the studio, Berman Obaldia. The play at California Stage is A Revolutionary Mind through July 17th. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruriak. Thanks for joining us.